Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Nihat the Truth. Back with us is Professor Geoffrey Roberts. He is a British historian specializing in Soviet diplomatic and military history of World War II. He is an emeritus professor of modern history at the University of University College Cork in Ireland. And there seems to be quite a few British professors and such that are in Ireland these days. Is that a trend, or is that from a lack of ability to work in England that Ireland offers better?
Well, certainly Ireland is a very prized destination for British academics at the moment, because conditions in Irish universities are much better than those in British universities. Obviously, you know, the two countries are adjacent. You know,
right.
Britain's got a big kind of population. It's kind of inevitable. You're going to get some migration from Britain to Ireland. And that's why I'm to me. I mean, that's why I'm in. I'm in Ireland. You know, I'm an economic migrant. You know, I came to Cork in 1992 for a job. And there's lots of people, you know, British or English, or actually not just that, all kinds of foreign backgrounds working in Irish universities.
Hello, dear friends. Just want to remind you, if you like this video or you like what you hear, click like, subscribe if you haven't subscribed yet, send it to your friends. Let's grow this channel. Maybe we can finally hit it up to 100,000. That'd be a good round number for the summer. So let me know, leave some comments, and give a thumbs up. So look forward to seeing you in the next video. Cheers.
Is it a matter of the Irish universities allow you more intellectual freedom? Or is it just more economic opportunity as far as better pay or more positions?
Well, the pay and conditions are quite good, I have to say, although I'm now retired. So, the Irish universities are less managerial than the British universities are these days. Yeah, there's quite strong guarantees of freedom of speech. You know, so for example, I've had some quite outspoken views in relation to the Ukraine war, but you know, I so far anyway, I've been able to speak my mind, no problem. But on the other hand, you know, I'm retired. If I was still in a job at my university, then it might be a different story. But I've certainly have never felt under any pressure in Ireland in terms of, you know, saying what I think. Yes.
Oh, that's good, because it seems Western universities these days, a lot like what was happening in the Soviet Union, especially toward the end, they have they start very much controlling the what is said and what's allowed to be discussed, the whole discussion, which is never good at the end of the day.
Sure.
Stagnation.
That's much more prevalent than it used to be. That's for certain. Yeah.
So I'd like to discuss your book. I was reading up on how much criticism you were having against the work for Stalin's wars, 1939-1953. And as I understand, you worked through the Soviet archives that were opened up after the fall of the Soviet Union. Was that difficult to get into the archives?
No, it wasn't. By the time I started working in the archives in 1996, and by that time, you know, access was fairly like regularized, and it was normal. You know, there were processes you had to go through to get access, but you know, there was no. I've never found it difficult getting access to Russian archives. The first archive I was given access to was the archive of the Foreign Ministry, the MID archive, which is a kind of rather peculiar archive, because in the MID archive, they won't tell you what holdings they have, what their files are. You know, you have to kind of guess at it, and you have to like define a subject matter. And then if you're lucky, they bring you some files which relate to the subject matter. And sometimes you didn't. Whereas other Russian archives, they all had like indexes, inventories, where you could see what files they had and which files were available for researchers to look at. So it wasn't getting access to the MID archive which was a problem. It was like finding ways to actually get hold of some interesting material. So for example, one of the ways you could do it is that if previous researchers used the archive and they had references to files and documents, you could cite those files and documents and request to see them yourselves. And generally, if some other researcher had seen a particular file, a particular document, then you were allowed to see it as well. But as I say, it was much easier working in other archives. And in general, you know, I've had a very, okay, there are some pitfalls of working these archives. There are lots of downsides to it. But when you sum it all up, I've had tremendous access to Soviet archives in the last 25 years or so, which has enabled me to produce, you know, I think a reasonable body of work which is firmly grounded in the available evidence.
Did you find the documents open? I mean, as far as what was written in there, or was it were they very redacted? And if so, do you think it was redacted by the writers themselves or later on?
If you get access to the documents, if you're given access to the documents, there's no redactions at all.
Mm.
No, absolutely not. No. I mean, if the way they redact documents is they won't show them to you at all. Then they're not declassified. But once a document has been declassified, there are no redactions. Of course, you know, there are certain types of documents you're never ever going to see. So, for example, intelligence documents, yes, or documents, some kind of types of documents connected with the military. Yeah, you're never going to get direct access to those documents. Although, in both cases, there's a huge amount of material has been published from the military archives and from the intelligence archive. So, I've never ever seen. I've looked at hundreds, thousands of files. Actually, I've never ever seen a redaction, as you put it, in any file or document that I've seen.
Yeah, you know, there's been some recent declassifications of I guess it was NKVD documents, particularly the international intelligence. I don't know if I doubted any of it was declared in the UK or any other country outside of Russia, but this was actually, I think, last year. And the documents pointed that Chamberlain, along with the French and some other powers in Europe, were looking at an invasion of the Soviet Union through Finland, through Iran, and were trying to convince Ataturk to open a front against the Soviet Union, aimed at 1941-42. Obviously, you know, with Hitler, that kind of changed the whole position timeline, but it seems that they were aiming to try to invade the Soviet Union. That's the archives that were, or the documents that were declassified last year from the mid-30s.
Yeah. There's actually quite a lot of intelligence information material that has been published from the archives, and actually quite a lot of it you can actually access online. For example, the Yeltsin Presidential Library in St. Petersburg, it has a lot of this material online. At one point, I should say now is that because of the current situation in Russian archives, as far as I know, have been closed down. Now, it doesn't impact on me personally because I've accumulated, you know, a kind of quite a big collection of copies of documents from the archives. So I have enough material to continue with my show. But hopefully, when the situation changes, the archives will open up. Will open up again. Yeah, I mean, the problem with like the material you just mentioned there is this. There's actually thousands of intelligence related documents that's been published from the archives. Thousands. That's not an exaggeration. Thousands, right? In various volumes or published online. The problem is assessing who read them and what actions were taken on about, you know, particularly, of course, Stalin. And it's very, very difficult. You know, there's all this material out there, but it's very, very difficult to actually work out whether Stalin read a particular document or series of documents and whether that impacted on its action. And the other thing about Stalin, of course, Stalin always thought he knew better. He knew better than his intelligence services. He was always very skeptical, particularly if the information was coming from spies. Yeah, I mean, Stalin was very skeptical about the about so you have this huge amount of material out there. I mean, it's really huge, really huge. But its actual value in terms of writing up the history of the period, it's quite limited. Okay, if you want to write up what Soviet intelligence officers or Soviet spies were reporting to Moscow, and this is what they were saying about what, yeah, that's quite interesting if you want to do that. But if you're trying to assess the impact of that material on decision making, that's much more problematic.
Yeah, we saw that. We saw that our grandparents, or my case, my grandparents would have been saw that in 1941, because there were ample people that warned that look, you know, the Germans are mobilizing. Well, the Germans, the Europeans, the new European Union is mobilizing, or the new European order. Let me rephrase that. In Poland, there's going to be an invasion, and Stalin just refused to hear anything about it. As I recall, I think it was 2 weeks or a month before his top generals were all asking to be allowed to at least partially mobilize, and they were denied.
That's interesting, because I hear what you say, and I've heard what you said many, many times before, and it's written down. It's a very common view about Stalin in relation to the German invasion. But my research in the Russian archives, Soviet archives, has led me to the conclusion that that's not the right story. That's not the correct explanation. And really what we need to focus on is Soviet military preparation for the war and expectations about how the war would unfold once the Germans attacked, right? And what that tells me is that Stalin, from what he was being told, from what his understanding of the situation, drew the conclusion, maybe the Germans are going to attack. And there's all this information suggesting that's the case. But on the other hand, it might be a provocation, so maybe not. But either way, we shouldn't respond to what could be a provocation. Because by responding to the provocation, we actually create the event itself. We bring the timing of the war forward. Mm-hmm. So that was Stalin's point of view. And he thought, his reasoning was this, is that even if he's wrong, even if it's not a provocation, even if the Germans are really going to invade, the invasion takes place, okay, it won't be very costly, because Soviet defences are strong enough to contain any initial German attack. And once those the initial German attack has been contained, then the Red Army will have time to actually prepare its own action, its own counter offensive action. So really the key to, you know, the big disaster of, you know, June 22nd, 1941 is, like, you know, when obviously the Germans invade, they punch their way through Soviet defenses, they occupy huge swathes of Soviet territory within weeks and months. They inflict millions of casualties on the Red Army. The key to understanding why that I can say tragedy, which is a tragedy, but, you know, it's that disaster, the strategic disaster unfolds. It's because Stalin, and not just Stalin, his generals felt confident about their defensive situation. Yeah. Because, of course, you know, okay, the Germans, Operation Barbarossa, there was like 3 million German and Allied troops involved in the invasion. Well, the Soviets had a 5 million strong army in 1941, most of which was deployed in the western regions of Europe. So the Soviets were actually quite confident about holding their defensive positions, right? They didn't think that they were going to be overrun like Poland was in 1939. Mm-hmm. They didn't think that they were going to collapse like France did in 1940. They were confident. And it's just not Stalin, it's his generals as well. It's both of them are confident. And of course, the other point to make about this is, of course, you know, okay, after Stalin dies, you know, he's attacked by Khrushchev at the 20th Party Congress, and one of the main attacks Khrushchev levels at Stalin, he was a bad war leader, and he refused to act on these warnings of a coming German attack. You know, the kind of the stuff that you were talking about in relation to your parents, right? And then, of course, there's all these Soviet generals piping in and saying, yeah, that's right. We warned Stalin. We wanted to do this. We wanted to do that. But he wouldn't listen to us. So we have this big disaster in June 1941. It's not that simple, right? But the generals themselves were culpable, right? Okay, Stalin's the supreme commander. So ultimately, he takes responsibility for all the decisions, including the huge disaster of the of Barbarossa, initial disaster. But his generals also have also played a part and also have their own responsibilities.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, you know, from my own research, it seems that the Soviet Union, the leadership of the Soviet Union, didn't really appreciate the scope of all of this until the disasters near Smolensk. When those last big armies were defeated is when everything went into overdrive as far as mass mobilization and everything else, because at that point they figured out that this was going to be a very long fight and a very hard fight, and they weren't going to be able to contain the Germans that easily.
I think they realized it, particularly Stalin, is much earlier than Smolensk battle. It's at the end of June, early July 1941, mm-hmm. when Minsk falls to the Germans, right? That's when it dawns on them. And of course, you know, from the very beginning, you know, there is, you know, look, the Soviet Union, even before the war, it was a society mobilized for a coming war, right? Stalin, you know, liked to describe it as, in fact, he did describe it, I think, in his first radio speech, you know, the Soviet Union is an armed camp, right? Well, that armed camp has been built up over you know, 10, 15 years. So, you know, and obviously when the war begins, there's further mobilization. I mean, mobilization was already in progress, full-scale mm-hmm. mobilization was already in progress, and then obviously it intensifies. So it's right from the very beginning that the mobilization, there's no delay whatsoever in the mobilization. But I think the Minsk is a big shock, particularly for Stalin, yes? Okay, and that's where, I think it's around the time of Minsk that, you know, he disappears to his dacha for a couple of days, yeah? And a lot of people have made a lot of fuss about, oh, he was having a nervous breakdown, or what was he doing? I think he was just, you know, trying to come to terms with the situation, right? Thinking about it, what's going on. I think he was also thinking about, you know, can he trust his military leaders? Can he trust his generals, basically? Given what the disaster that's happened, particularly mm-hmm. the Minsk disaster. Okay, and he comes to the conclusion that, okay, he can't trust some of them, and some generals are indeed executed, but he can trust others. For example, Zhukov, right? Okay, so then you mentioned Smolensk. Oh, Smolensk is really important because in the high summer of 1941, July and August, right, there's a whole series of big battles take place in the Smolensk area, right? And it's okay, and you know, the Germans eventually win those battles, overcome Soviet resistance, but it's hugely costly for them, and it delays their advance on Moscow, right? So it's that, in a way, okay, you know, the Germans do get to Moscow by October 1941, but by the time they get there, they're exhausted, yes, they've taken a lot of losses, right? So it was actually the battles around Smolensk that actually saved Moscow from being captured by the Germans in autumn of 1941.
Then there's there's the battles of Taganrog that nobody seems to remember, that Major General Mikhail Zimin was commanding. The first big defeat for the Wehrmacht Army Group Zund. They're supposed to be going into the deep encirclement of Moscow across the Don, and they never quite made it. They got pushed back about 200 kilometers from Taganrog. Right. But I stumbled across that. As much as I read military history, I stumbled across because nobody ever talks about that whole series of battles.
I mean, I'm not sure that I could talk about it either. I mean, the big series of battles race to Moscow, which I know about, is the battles around Tula. It's mm-hmm. the Tula era, yeah.
Right.
There's huge battles there, and that's basically, that stops the Germans from encircling or penetrating into Moscow. I haven't heard of this other reaction you're talking about. Yeah, so yeah, that sounds interesting.
And the interesting part is there was no Army Corps per se. They pulled everything they had. They had with the 31st Rifle Division. They had the 44th Home Guard, which is basically factory workers, Kazakh units, Kazakh battalions and brigades that were self-organized, self-armed. I mean, they just threw everything they had. And the good thing was an early and very, very heavy winter, so they were able to cross the water obstacles. And sometimes attacking flat out against entrenched German positions across frozen lakes.
Right.
But they crushed Army Group's Zund and pushed it back. But that was right before the big battles for Moscow was starting. So I guess
What was the name of the general in charge?
Let me see. It was, because I'm horrible with names. Zeman.
Zeman.
Mikhail Zeman.
Okay. Thanks. I'll check that out.
Yeah, I ran across I ran across a documentary film by the 90s. Most textbooks don't talk about it, but that was the first actual pushback of an entire army group.
Okay.
They came back in 42, reorganized towards Stalingrad, but.
Yeah, what's usually said is that the first big pushback of the Germans was the battle that Zhukov waged against them in the Smolensk area in August 1941. The name of the battle escapes me, despite the fact that I'm Zhukov's biographer. I just can't bring the name. Okay, but he has this famous battle, which is said to be the first time the Germans actually experience defeat him on the battlefield, and they're pushed back. Yeah, but it sounds like this. What you're saying to me here is that there's an earlier example.
Well, it wasn't earlier. It was I guess after Smolensk, but it was bigger example. Much because they actually pushed back an entire army group.
It's come back. The Yelnaya, Zhukov's Yelnaya counteroffensive in August. Yeah, August 1941. Yeah, sure. Yeah, right. But of course, okay. So Zhukov's counterattack is quite successful, but it's only a temporary success because the Germans, they launch their own counteraction and push Zhukov's forces back.
It's amazing. Well, the Western histograph is that the Soviet Union just buried the Germans in bodies, and that's how they won the war. But if you start looking at the actual casualty figures, by 1944 maybe second half of 1943 or 1944, these, for example, these German fortress cities like Königsberg, where the Germans were dug in, cities are supposed to last 6 months, fall in 2 weeks, and the German defender takes more casualties than the Soviet attacker.
Sure.
The total reversal of casualty figures.
The Red Army gets better and better as the war goes on, that's for sure. Yeah, because it was David Glenn's called it a learning organization. Yeah, experience. It adapted, changed its tactics, strategy, equipment, training, gained us experience. Yeah, I mean, by the time we come to the war's end, it's probably the most formidable fighting machine in the whole of human history. The Red Army in 1945, and actually the campaign which people say is like it's a peak of Soviet operational art and military prowess is not in Europe. It's actually the one in Manchuria.
Yes, Kwantung Army.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, they destroyed Japan's Kwantung Army in just a few days, and obviously helped to precipitate the end of the Pacific War. Yeah.
The American side particularly doesn't want to talk about that at all because the U.S. says they defeated all the Japanese forces, and here's an army of 1 million men that were wiped out in 2 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. The Americans obviously want to emphasize. Well, they want to emphasize their own like fighting in the Far East, which is not you'd expect that. Yeah, but obviously they want to emphasize the role that the atomic bomb played in precipitating the Japanese surrender. Now, I think the atomic bomb was a factor, but I think the Soviet, the Red Army's Manchurian campaign was of equal importance. And then also more recently, there's been some recent historiography, including from Japanese historians, and there's a British historian called Richard Overy, and he's written published a very interesting book about, it's called Ruin from the Air, and it's basically about the bombing of Tokyo in March 1945, where they were like a mass bombing of firebombing of Tokyo and mass kind of casualties. But the point that Overy makes and Japanese historians make in terms of when the Japanese are considering whether or not they should end the war, whether they should accept surrender. Yeah. Okay. The atomic, the firebombing of Tokyo as well as the atomic bombs are a big factor. What's going on in Manchuria as well, that's a big factor. But the other thing that's really shaping their perception of the situation and what they need to do was that there was a danger of communist revolution.
Ah, really?
And yeah, that's what they're worried about. They're worried about a Soviet invasion, which would lead to a communist revolution in Japan. Yeah? And so Soviet communist subversion, right? So from their point of view, that actually posed a threat to the very nature of Japanese society. You know, it seemed to them as to be a dire threat to the continued existence of Japan as this particular historical, traditional kind of society. So that political calculation was very much before as well. So just showed that, you know, okay, what we're talking about, you know, the war, you know, all the issues we talk about have been studied intensively, obviously for decades, and you know, the amount of literature available and the information is huge, but still there are new things to learn, I find, anyway, about that history.
Yeah, I read about the Soviet, the Red Army's, or I guess it was the Marines, taking of the northern Kuril Islands. And the Japanese garrisons, they're expecting an American model where, you know, fleet shows up, they bomb you for a week or two, they land out in the open, and so as the bombing starts coming down, you shoot back, and you have a nice little fight over the island. And instead, and they come with overwhelming force, and instead you get heavy fog, rain, small garrisons of Soviet Marines coming through the fog, landing on the islands, no artillery preparation, no bombardment, charging in. And while the Japanese are still eating their rice, they got guys with people standing over them going, it's over. You know, surprise, we're here. They don't. Yeah. The Russians wouldn't fight like civilized people. They just showed up out of the fog.
That's a really great story, yeah. Thanks for sharing that.
Scared the crap out of the Japanese.
And of course, the Kuril Islands are still a matter of territorial dispute between Russia and Japan. Yeah.
Well, there's a geostrategical aspect in that. I mean, Russia's willing and has been for a long time willing to co-economically develop those islands, but they'll never let. Sure. For if no other reason than the fact Japan is a vassal of the U.S. And allow, you know, any of those islands, even one of those islands, to go into Japanese hands, it's an instant military base. It's an instant entry point into the entire region up to Kamchatka and Sakhalin.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's just never going to be allowed. For geostrategic positioning. Japanese could be upset, but
Stalin was expecting not just the Kurils to be invested by Soviet troops, but also Hokkaido. Hokkaido, I mean, that was, they had the plans, they were in preparation. Yep. So that was kind of Stalin's concept, is that there would be a joint invasion of Japan, just like there had been of Germany, of course, and Japan would be divided into zones of occupation, military occupation, just like Germany had been, right? And the Soviets would actually get their zone, and obviously it would be in Hokkaido, but that didn't happen. The atomic bomb, Manchuria, what we discussed earlier, that precipitated an end to the war earlier than everyone expected. So Stalin was quite, like, in some ways quite disappointed with that. Of course, it saved a lot of lives.
Washington was predicting something like 2 million casualties for the U.S. To take the Japanese home islands.
Yeah, it would have. I don't know. It would. The casualties would be enormous. But of course, most of the casualties would have been on the Japanese side. Of course. Particularly Japanese civilians. Okay, mm-hmm. but the outcome of the, you know, because there was no like Soviet occupation of Hokkaido, right? That meant okay, the Soviet Union was part of the military occupation of Japan, but only in a kind of consultative advisory capacity. Yeah, basically the Germans, the Americans controlled controlled the situation. Yeah.
Yeah, I think Stalin was a victim of his own success, because that Kwantung Army was the one that was supposed to be shipped over to Japan to defend the home islands for the American nation. Right, exactly. No Kwantung Army.
Yeah, it's it was the last hope, wasn't it? The last major intact Japanese military force in summer 45 was the Kwantung Army.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, the incredible thing is, quite literally, Soviets had built, and they were preparing it in 44. Stalin had built tunnels underneath rivers north of the Manchuria border to hide large movements of equipment. Right. So you didn't see them over bridges. You couldn't see them. They just disappear into the ground and then appear somewhere on the other side. And the Stalin II tanks, the Joseph Stalin II, so I had such a powerful gun that they were, I mean, granted, Japanese armor was pretty light. They had some medium tanks. I mean, they really screwed up tank development. But there were quite literal cases where Soviet, Stalin II tanks were taking out two medium Japanese tanks with one shot. It was going through one, hitting the next one in line, and still going after that. Cutting right through them, which is pretty incredible if you think about it. I mean, two tanks with one shot is those fantasy things you see in Hollywood, but there were multiple such cases.
Right. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So you're stretching my kind of like knowledge of the technology.
Yeah. Well, the Stalin II, I think it only saw on the Western Front for the Battle of Berlin. I mean, at the very, very end. And the Stalin III, that was already post-war. There's some questions whether they ever saw combat, the Stalin III, but I think most people say, you know, it came out already in the second half of 45.
I mean, okay, so I suppose I should confess, I'm not really a military historian, despite the fact I've written a book about Stalin's war leadership. I've written a biography of Zhukov, written a book about the Battle of Stalingrad, all kinds of other stuff. I'm not really a military historian. I'm kind of a political historian primarily, but I'm interested. It's like it's the strategic level, yeah. Mm-hmm. My book about Stalin, which you mentioned, Stalin's Wars, is a study of Stalin at the strategic level. Yeah, so it's at that kind of level. Yeah, and I'm sure I'm kind of like, you know, I'm interested in, you know, the tactical level, the technology, the details, and also the experience of kind of, well, but in terms of my expertise, I defer to I defer to people like yourself, right? And maybe Alexander Hill and people like that who have this like detailed like knowledge of the hardware and, you know, the technology and you know, the tactics and that kind of thing.
I like geopolitics too. Have you ever read Enemy of the Gates?
Yeah, of course.
The book was crap from War of the Rats, and they just stole the title. The actual book.
Yes, I've read the book. Yeah, of course. Well, I wrote a book on the Battle of Stalingrad myself.
Right,
so,
right.
Victory of Stalingrad. Yeah. So obviously, I read the book. I actually thought that was. Obviously the famous book about Stalingrad, famous Western book, is Anthony Beevor's
Stalingrad book. Yeah, I got it on a bookshelf over here.
I actually thought in many ways Enemy at the Gates was a better book.
Yeah. It was on a personal level. It was on a human level.
I think it brought across the drama of the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
The grandeur of the great, actually much better than Anthony Beevor's book.
Well, Beevor's book didn't have much on the human factor. It had a lot on the tactics used, on the equipment used. And you know, considering it was written by a Western, you could say, you know, it had more. Some would say some of the books written would have more leanings toward maybe the Germans. I think it was a very good neutral book on Stalingrad. But Enemy of the Gates was a personal thing. And the interesting thing is, the guy had permission from the Soviet Union in 1971 to travel the Soviet Union. And interview people interview survivors, veterans. And it's not only Soviet. I mean, obviously he interviewed Romanians and Hungarians and Italians and Germans.
That was true earlier as well. I mean, what was the guy who did The Longest Day, the book about The Longest Day, about the D-Day invasion, right? Just my memory of the name is terrible. But he after that book, he wrote a book about the Battle for Berlin, right? Beaver wrote about book about. Okay, but what's his bloody name? Anyway, a book about it. And he went to... He went to the Soviet Union for part of his research, and he talked to all kinds of Soviet generals about the Battle for Berlin in 1945. The one general Cornelius Ryan, Ryan, he wrote The Longest Day, and then the follow-up to that book was the book about the Battle of Berlin, right? The one general he wasn't allowed to speak to was the most important general, of course, and that was Zhukov. Because at that time, we're talking about 1961, 62, that kind of early 60s anyway. Zhukov was in disgrace, you know. He'd been sacked, forced to resign. Right. Yeah, and he was in bad odour, because Khrushchev decided to get rid of him, and forced him into retirement. So he wasn't allowed to speak to Zhukov. But he spoke to a lot of other generals, yeah. So this idea that the Soviet Union was kind of closed, kind of like, totalitarian society—it doesn't add up. Once you actually drill down into the details of what's actually happening, there's no truth to it whatsoever.
Oh, you know, for closed totalitarian society, you ever heard of the American House?
No.
Exhibit.
In 1950, that one.
Yeah, that they showed a modern American house.
Oh yeah,
had like
yeah,
three
yeah, of
or
course,
four
yeah.
million people come through it.
Right,
for this closed society that absolutely nothing's allowed in or out, and then you set up an exhibit of American, technology.
Wasn't that exhibition staged at Verdun Car? Wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
I was at Verdun Car 3-4 weeks ago.
Oh, okay. You sure let me know. I come said hi.
You're in Moscow, are you?
Yeah.
Okay, fine, right.
So next time, let me know. I'll
Sure. Do that.
We'll be quite happy to come meet you. Yeah, and it lasted for several months. They were talking about 3 or 4 million people went to see it. So for a closed society, when you allow some, which in the 1950s, the U.S. was already, the number one geopolitical opponent. Yeah. And they allowed some of that.
Of course, there was a major kind of opening up of Soviet society after Stalin's death in 1953. Although a lot of this, I mean, there is this kind of idea that in the late Stalin period, like late 40s, early 50s, the Soviet Union was a very isolated kind of place. I don't think that's actually true. There was quite a lot of openness in that period as well. Mm-hmm. But certainly what is true after Stalin's death, it becomes much more open in terms of its contacts with the outside world, particularly the West. And this kitchen, the American House, this is the one where Nixon, is this where Nixon visits it, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. This is the same place. And they have like him and Khrushchev have the so-called the kitchen debate. That's the place.
There's something else that nobody really talks about. You know, Stalin tried to organize an ecumenical council in Moscow back about 1951. He had the patriarch of, because he reinstated a patriarchy, and he had the patriarch go in and try to organize an ecumenical council of Orthodox churches in Moscow and turn Soviet Union into the epicenter of Orthodoxy. He failed because the Greek churches, Athens, Constantinople, at that point, Antioch, Alexandria, they were all under the CIA and the CIA. No way in hell you're going up to the Soviet Union for an ecumenical council. So that fell through. But yeah, he Sergei Posad, which was the throne of the patriarchy, that there was only one church left in 22 June 1941 that was getting ready to be demolished. And from what people are saying, Stalin had a come to Jesus moment. He got scared. And because I mean, he had been in seminary, he was supposed to become a priest, And then after that, the Sergei Posada was rebuilt using the Komsomolsev. They were encouraged to go rebuild the churches.
Yeah.
So that's something that that's not very often said. I'm not saying he became an overly religious man, but maybe he did. I don't know what's in his mind.
Yeah, no, I'm just not. I don't buy this line that, you know, that that Stalin found Jesus again. Ever.
Who knows?
Who knows? I think I know. the evidence says completely the contrary that he didn't. So it's pure speculation. But it's interesting you say about his effort to establish this ecumenical council of the mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's an example of like outreach to the outside world, right?
Right.
And that's like you said, 1951. Yeah, there's no.
Yeah, that goes in on 1951 or 1950, it was right before his.
Yeah. In 1952, there's a big like world like economic conference mm-hmm. that the Soviet stage in Moscow, right? Kind of business yep. kind of thing. Yeah, where they're trying to. Business links, various Western companies, right?
There's a
lot of stuff that I know about going on in relation to the peace movement, yeah? Because mm-hmm. you get this massive peace movement develops internationally mm-hmm. from the late 1940s onwards, right? And that spawns various kind of like connections between peace activists and peace organizations all over the world, including, of course, the Soviet Union being at the very center. So there's a lot, you know, this supposedly isolationist period of late Stalinism. That's the image people have it. There's actually a lot going on in terms of the Soviet Union's connections with the outside world. But at the same time, it's still true to say that there is a there's much more relaxation,
right?
And much more openness after Stalin dies, for sure.
You know, there was even a case Stalin awarded Hero of the Soviet Union, the civilian version, to 17 priests in St. Petersburg. Who held their churches open because they kept morale up in Leningrad as it was under siege.
Right.
There was a lot of, you know, I think a lot of the certain levels of repression, anyways, faded away very quickly when the war started.
Yeah, well, of course, during the Second World War, there's this big reconciliation between, Stalin and the Orthodox Church. And
church bought a battalion of tanks.
Religion in general, wasn't just the Orthodox Church. I mean, there was a different policy towards all other religions, Islam and so on. Yeah, yeah. Obviously, it's part of the Great Patriotic War, mm-hmm. the mobilization of the Great Patriotic War. So there's a new kind of like relationship that develops, and that continues after the war and continues well right away until the end of the Soviet regime. Because look, Khrushchev rediscovered his militant atheism from time to time, and there were some repressive measures under him. Yeah.
Yeah, the church even bought the Alexander Nevsky battalion. The church gathered money, bought a battalion of tanks, of T-34s. Khrushchev, interestingly enough, when Khrushchev was removed by the Politburo, one of the points that they removed him for was excess pressure on the church. He'd gone overboard. His Mills and atheism.
Yeah, so that's an interesting point. I actually haven't, that hadn't occurred to me. Because obviously, you think about Khrushchev's removal to do with like his relationships with other members of the leadership, which is very poor, it's very domineering.
Oh, yeah.
It's to do with the disruptions of some of his economic reforms, which didn't turn out very well. And some people argue that what some people saw as a retreat. In relation to the Cuban situation, the Cuban mm-hmm. missile crisis, but I've never heard that point about the
I mean, it makes
absolute sense that that would be part of the indictment of Khrushchev. Yeah.
It was a pretty long indictment.
Khrushchev's mm-hmm. departure, of course, is very important from my point of view, or from Zhukov's point mm-hmm. of view, because it's post Khrushchev that Zhukov is rehabilitated as a great Soviet war hero.
Yeah. And he deserves it. I mean, starting with the fight with the Japanese. Nobody seems to remember that either in Mongolia. Which, I mean, if you think about that fight in Mongolia, which, while the Japanese didn't take giant casualties, I think they were like 50,000 KIA, that changed the entire course of the war. Because the Southern Party won, and they went south to expand the empire instead of going to Siberia.
Yeah. I mean, I think in general, the problem with the northern strategy, Japanese strategy was, which is a kind of expansion in the Soviet direction, yeah, and also in China, was that the Chinese war hadn't gone very well for the Japanese. Yes, been very cut. So, and I think, Halkin Gol, Zhukov's victory, Halkin Gol on the Mongolian border with Manchuria, reinforced that message. Yeah, the immense difficulties of expansion in the northern direction, as opposed to, the southern strategy of seizing control of Southeast Asia and, obviously attacking the American fleet at Pearl Harbor and so on.
Yeah, Halkin Gol, by the way, the first time the T-34 came into actual combat action.
Right.
It scared the crap out of the Japanese. They had nothing they could stop them with. They had light tanks.
Although, it was a great victory, but the enemy wasn't necessarily.
They were suicidally brave, throw themselves underneath the tank to blow it up, but that only has a limited effect. It gets an entire tank battalion with infantry mounted. And the Japanese tanks at that point were extremely light. They were basically tankettes, a little upgraded, the French tankettes from World War One. They're just slightly upgraded machine gun tanks. Mark Ones, Mark Twos, German. Right. So Panzer Kampfwagen. Right. So the Japanese never were good at building tanks back then. They
They're pretty good at building cars nowadays.
Yes. And very good
many
planes.
Many other things. Everything else, yes.
The Zero was a very good plane. But the tanks were just... Well, you know what was interesting was the German super submarines, the transport submarines, when Americans started running into German 88s on Japanese islands.
Right,
lighting them up. They were disassembling these and shipping them in large enough numbers, to the Japanese.
Right. Okay, and very good. The anti-aircraft gun you're talking about.
Yeah. It was original anti-aircraft gun, but it was the best cannon in the entire war.
Exactly. Of course, yeah. So, and anti-tank weapon as well, of course,
Anti-tank. It became a tank gun. The Germans remounted on their Panzers Panthers. The Panther had the 88.
I do know something about the technology. It's coming back into my mind. Yes.
Yeah. The problem when the Germans invaded the Soviet Union, they were bad enough trying to fight the first model of the T-34s. When the KV-1s came out, that was it. The only thing they could take on a KV-1 was an 88. And by the time you mounted the 88, there's nothing left of that 88.
Right,
it was in the anti-aircraft mode, you have to bring it up, tow it up, put it, get them out. And meanwhile, the KV-1 is looking at it and opening fire on it. So just driving right over it. So those were monster tanks. Just gigantic monster tanks. Have you ever read anything about German tank construction in World War One?
No, I haven't. Sorry.
There's a reason for that. It almost didn't exist. Achtung Panzer.
What you said, yes.
Yeah. Guderian's Achtung Panzer is very worth reading, as he goes over these battles
in the First World War.
First World War. The Germans, I'm going to tell you exactly how many tanks the Germans built. Now, these were those giant land tanks that were like 11-man crew that looked like a ship. They built 47. 47 tanks.
Right.
And they captured another 45 Mark IIs and then the French tanks that they repurposed and resent. So they had a whole tank force of under 100 tanks through the whole war. Right. And the high command came out with, our soldiers are brave. They'll figure it out. and the Western allies built between the different British Mark I's, Mark IIs, and then the tankettes from all different sizes. They built like 5,000 tanks.
Right.
Against 100.
I didn't realize that they produced that many.
Some of these, a large number of them were tankettes, where you had a two-man crew, basically a machine gunner and a driver. And the machine gunner was standing. There wasn't even a place for him to sit down.
Sure.
Those are French tankettes, but against rifles, they were pretty damn effective. It's a book worth reading. It's a very interesting book, just as a history book of World War One, the final battles.
Yeah, I have to say I haven't read it. Obviously, I know about it.
Yeah, it's a good work. It definitely should be in everybody's library if you're studying military history. Because that's what it was meant, you know, teach the Germans that, hey, it didn't work the first time. We don't need to do this the second time the same way. They take a different path. So, well, what do you think? I mean, lately, there's just been big drive to try to drive Stalin out of the history, period. It's the Soviet people. It was, you know, as if the whole country just organized itself without any leadership. And then trying to emphasize that, yeah, Stalin was in depression for the first 2 months, things like that.
I haven't particularly, you're talking about in Russia, are you?
No, in the West. And Russia is going quite the opposite direction these days.
I haven't particularly noticed that myself. It's quite a difficult thing to do. I'd say that, you know, Stalin, yeah, remains a central figure. But specifically in relation to the Second World War, yeah. I mean, you mentioned earlier, you know, okay, you talk about in your introduction Stalin's wars and controversial book and stuff like that. Well, I think that was true at the time, but actually it's not so true these days, because, you know, okay, the book was published 20 odd years ago, yeah, mm-hmm. 2006, yeah, 20 years ago. But now it's kind of like its central kind of like narrative and argument, you know, that Stalin was actually quite an effective war leader, and we can actually demonstrate this through the actual story of the war from his perspective, and, you know, the function of the Soviet High Command and all the battles and so on. That kind of argument of mine, okay, it wasn't my only me put that argument. It's quite generally accepted. Yeah, it's, you know, okay, it's grudging acceptance about a lot of people, but the idea that, well, in a very real sense, you know, Stalin was a great war leader, mm-hmm. is, I think, you know, I'd almost say that's the consensus now. Now, of course, people also say, you know, he was also a great monster, some people say, or he was a dictator, and, you know, and there would be, he might have been effective during the war, but he was ineffective in other things. So there's certainly, obviously, there's an argument about Stalin, but certainly in terms of his reputation as a war leader, I would say it's still riding pretty high. And okay, some people might want to write him out of the story, but it's completely impossible to do given what the Second World War was and what actually happened. You know?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if you've read into any archival documents on this, but from what I've read and what at least. In some of the scholarly works, Stalin in 1948, as NATO is being formed, Stalin asked to join NATO to set up a European peace structure. Which, by the way, interesting enough, Nicholas II was the one that first started pushing for a League of Nations and a comprehensive European peace structure. So, you know, from the 1880s, and that didn't quite work out, unfortunately.
Yeah. It's a very interesting point. Yeah. Well, actually, you can take it back further. Now you can go back to, you know, Alexander the First. Yeah, you can go further back.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah. In fact, I'm kind of like writing an article about that very topic. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But in terms of what you said about the NATO business, yeah. Now, okay. Now, well, of course, what happened was that it wasn't Stalin. It was actually Molotov. Molotov mm-hmm. in 1954. Made a proposal on behalf of the Soviet government that if NATO was a defensive organization, like claimed, then the Soviet Union would be interested in becoming a member of that organization. Okay, and the proposal is like pitched in the form of, you know, at that time, you know, the Soviet Union, Molotov, had a campaign for European collective security, right? For a common European collective security space, which, by the way, is still, you know, the position of the Russian government. So it was part of that. So the idea was, you know, Soviet Union can join NATO. We can have this common collective security organization, which the United States could be a part of, right? And then we'd have, like, well, okay, a common European, a new kind of structure of security. You know, so that's it. That's in 1954. Now, but there were precedents for that. Is that even when Stalin was still alive, the Soviets were saying, "Well, what, you know, maybe we should join NATO." Yeah,
right.
Yeah, and including, I think there is one statement by Stalin to that effect. But it's not until 54, after Stalin's death, that the Soviets actually make a formal proposal that the Soviet Union should join NATO. And of course, if we jump forward to post-Soviet times, it's very definitely the case that Russia, post-Soviet Russia, was interested, very interested in the possibility of becoming a member of NATO, but only on the basis of being a kind of like an equal and full partnership, you know, between Russia and the West. Right? They weren't interested in becoming a subordinate, you know, within the NATO structures. And of course, the whole, you know, the whole project of, you know, a common European collective security system, that project continues to be pursued by Russia in post-Soviet times. Now, currently, I mean, Putin has started talking less about European security and more about Eurasian security. So apparently Putin's thinking is that what you need is Eurasian, mm-hmm. pan-Eurasian, pan-European Asian security structures, not just European ones. But what that means in practice, in detail, is not clear.
Yeah, it's sad that, you know, for even if you don't take Alexander the First and post Napoleon, and just even if you just start with Nicholas II, that's already 140 years to establish a peace structure for Europe.
Yeah,
if we could have avoided World War One, my God, the history. Sure. Yeah. I'm not even going to talk World War Two, but just World War One, it's just been an entirely radical, different development of humanity.
Yeah. And the interesting thing, of course, is the question, well, why did these, like, Russian and Soviet and post-Soviet Russian attempts at common European security fail? How do you explain the failure? Yeah. Okay. Long story, but I think you explain the failure because consistently Russia is seen as being a threat. Yeah. Being an adversary or a potential adversary, rather than being an ally and a friend. Yeah. And that's, you know, in a sense, that's why, you know, we're in the situation we're in today, because of this perception, you know, that Russia in the West, that Russia is a dangerous adversary, and it, you know, you can't ally with it, you can't have friendship with it, you can't be part of the same street. What you need to do, you need some way, find means of containing Russia, and preferably not just containing Russian power, but actually undermining Russian power and weakening Russia as a great power. And so that kind of, like, you know, the current story about, well, is actually, you can trace back, I don't know, 200 years.
Oh yeah. It's kind of like, if you look at German politics, you know, the party that's the evil psychopaths are the ones that are going, hey, why don't we have peace and have a normal economic policy and not militarize? You know, oh, no, you can't have talks with the alternative future for Deutschland. They're crazies. They're Nazis, because they want to have peace and just live a normal economic life. It's the same concept. You know, oh, the Russians want peace again. Damn it. Sure. Let's start a war. Why? I looked it up real quick. I was wrong. It wasn't 1951. It was 1948. And they did have a pan-Orthodox conference, but it wasn't the Ecumenical Council because they couldn't get the Greeks in. The Greeks were already fully under the CIA, so they confused the different Greek church, Orthodox churches. They had the Romanians, the Bulgarians, you know, the Georgian Patriarchy. Obviously, Georgian Patriarchy is part of Russia.
Thanks for that. Another thing I've learned from you today. I'll check that out. Yeah.
So that was an attempt. He was trying to make the Soviet Union a center of Orthodoxy. Didn't work out. It's like, thanks, good try. But and history rolls on. It was because I always thought it was 48 when Stalin. So it was, it's interesting that it was Molotov in
53. 54. 54. Yeah, 54. Molotov was the one who, this is post-Stalin, developed the idea of European collective security, a pan-European collective security system.
And, you know, Yeltsin also asked, and I was talking with Colonel Wilkerson, who was chief of staff for Colin Powell, both in the military and when Powell became Secretary of State. And he said George Senior, the George Senior White House, they were literally looking at it as a realistic thing and bringing up plans. But one, George Bush Senior lost the re-election, and two, Clinton with his little problem with stains on dresses and his various liaisons, he needed to look tough. So he said, that's why they did deep sixed it. They needed to look tough against somebody to get their credibility back. And who better looked tough against than the Russians at the moment? So they deep sixed that whole initiative from Yeltsin.
But I think they deep sixed it, you put it, because they felt they could. They had the luxury to do it
Oh yeah,
because Russia,
absolutely.
because Russia in the 1990s was very weak, so they could treat it, in that way. So I think that.
I think George Bush Sr. had a better understanding. He was former head of the CIA. He had a better understanding of what was going on. He's, by the way, the last one that could control the Israelis too. He cut him, he
Well,
quite literally cut him off
well,
from supplies as punishment.
you say that about George Senior to Bush and all that, but he was the one who like originated this kind of narrative of America's victory.
Oh yeah, oh, absolutely. I'm not excusing him. I'm not a big
Which the
fan of that.
foundations, which is the foundation stone of all the kind of like the very negative poor strategy that the Americans pursued towards Russia after the Soviet. So I think also the Americans see other states in Europe as being more important than Russia. I mean in Central Europe, Eastern Europe, former Soviet bloc. That's their priority, is to develop relationships with them. And obviously, ultimately, to expand NATO into Central. So Russia always takes second place, all along until, of course, Putin comes along and shakes things up a bit, and this is
Oh, yeah.
a more equal relationship begins to develop between Russia and NATO and Russia and the United States.
Well, toward in toward the end of 99, I got transferred into 18th Airborne Corps headquarters, G3. I was a captain, and lo and behold. During that time, except for when we were planning the invasion of Iraq and taking Baghdad, everything, all scenarios, everything was being worked out against Russia, which in the end is why I finally left, because I didn't want to participate in that. And that, yeah, it up to 99, it was, I think, pretty lackadaisical because they're like, it's going to die in its own anyways. Yeltsin's making sure it'll collapse. And then after 99, it's like, something went wrong. It's things suddenly start turning around. Chechnya 2's over, and then the alarm bells start going off at that point. So that's not going to plan. But yeah, I don't know where George Bush Senior would have gone with it if he had gotten reelected. But we know which way Clinton went. That was
Sure.
definitely the expansion of NATO, and on and on and on. Unfortunately, but and the rest is history, and we're here we are.
But even so, even in the face of that treatment, and NATO expansion has developed, there's still, not just Yeltsin, but Putin was interested
Oh yeah.
in developing a collaborative relationships
Well,
with the
Putin
United States,
flat out asked.
including the possibility of NATO membership. Now,
Yes, yes.
I think, NATO membership is definitely off the agenda now, but the idea of a collaborative relationship between Russia and the United States, it seems to me, is still central, at least central to remain central to help to Putin's thinking about world politics. Now, how long that can persist, and it obviously depends on how various things work out. But it's actually amazing the persistence with which Russia has pursued cooperation, collaboration with the United States. Which I
It's
think, by the way, sorry, I think it's a good
yeah.
thing. I'm not one of those people who criticize the Russians or Putin for doing that. What I lament is the fact that they failed. Yes, that
Yes.
they failed in the face of of Western negativity.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, most Americans don't know that A, the Russian Empire helped them get their independence. And B, the Russian Empire was on the side of the Union during the Civil War, which may have been a mistake. I think that was more emotional at that point. Alexander II was still a little bit sore about the Crimean War 10 years earlier.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
I think if you looked further on, it would have gone, maybe we should side with the South after all. But history is what history is. He was just where the British and the French will be on the other side, which is not a good way to make policy, but it is what it is, unfortunately. And you would think, I mean, like it or not, for the Europeans, Russia is 42% of Europe. By PPP, Russia is the biggest economy of Europe. It's got the biggest military force of Europe. It's got most of the resources of Europe. It's got most of the farmland of Europe. It's got the biggest population of any European country. You'd think you'd want normal relationships.
Absolutely, absolutely. It makes complete rational sense for that to be the case. Yes, absolutely.
It's and what nobody talks about, Russia has, I think, the fourth or fifth largest economic manufacturing base in the world. So
Right.
it's a huge manufacturing house too. It's
Sure,
not just oil
absolutely.
and gas.
I mean, I remain like hopeful, optimistic that that possibility might realize it. So obviously, at the moment, things look very negative as far as Russia's relationships with Europe is concerned. But I don't know, things can turn around very very quickly. Political situation in Europe could turn around very. Very quickly, if Marine Le Pen wins the French presidency in a couple of years' time, that could radically alter the geopolitics between Russia and Europe. Who knows? And so I'm kind of like I'm hoping that Russia persists in its pursuit of improved relations with Europe into the future.
What about Farage? When Brexit happened, there was a lot of hope that it'd finally be able to develop normal trade relations and everything with the UK, and they were developing. And then everything went very bad. Any chance of a Farage change in British politics, or is it just a home for disenfranchised Tories and same politics as before?
I think a Farage premiership, prime ministership, it would shake up British politics. Very hard to predict in what kind of direction, but certainly Farage himself, and I think the reform movement in general doesn't kind of like share the hostility towards Russia and Putin. That kind of consensus among the establishment parties. So yeah, that and also the Green Party in the UK is also its strength is increasing. And okay, they have they've had a very like pro-Ukrainian line in the current court, but the impression I have is that they're open to at least negotiation, at least talking to Russia, to Putin. About things of mutual benefit. Yes, and of course the new German situation, the AfD, Alternative for Deutschland. Yeah, I mean, who knows what's gonna happen there. And then other countries as well. So at the moment it's a very like pessimistic picture in terms of the current state of Russia's relationships with Europe. But that's to it's Russia's relationships with the present like European political elite, those who have the power at the present time. I mean, but all like the hostility there is between Russia and Europe at present time, I don't see that as being very deep rooted in terms of popular sentiment. I don't see any real evidence that there's a deep rooted anti hostility towards Russia among European people. Certainly, there's some, which is not surprising given the kind of like the propaganda, anti-Russia propaganda that's been intensively spreading in the West, particularly in the last 5 years, five years. But there's no like inherent deep reasons why the political situation in Europe can't turn around quite quickly, and that can't have beneficial effects as far as Europe's relationships with Russia are concerned. But the most but the, what's obviously what's crucial in that regard is obviously that the war in Ukraine has to come to an end, right? That nothing's going to happen until the war ends. And also the war has to end on a kind, some kind of a negotiated basis. There has to be a stable, some kind of settlement that stabilizes the situation. That's the context in which you could get quite a radical, quite a quick reconstruction of relations between Russia and Europe. If that doesn't happen, the war drags on in some form, then of course, we could be in the situation we're in now for many more years to come.
Yeah. Well, until, as long as you have the more radical elements in the European Union that are in power, the Zelensky types that are making money off of this war to the very end. Unfortunately, I don't see too many things happening without an actual major move on the battlefield.
Yeah, it depends what happens on the battlefield. Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, depends on your view. I mean, my view is that, it depends what happens on the battlefield. Yeah, sure. That's right. But the thing about these, radical elements, I mean, the key to one of the most important things to understand the current situation is that these radical elements, as you put it, they want to see an escalation of the war in Ukraine, right? And one of the things that obviously Putin and his government, they're resisting that provocation, right? My concern is that the provocation might become so intense that there might have to be some kind of response.
Yep. What's their aim? That's absolutely their aim. It's to up the ante to a point where there's going to be no choice but a response.
Yeah, I think that's right. Except they don't actually have the antes up. Yeah, they don't really have that much to up. I mean, obviously at the moment there's a lot of focused on the long range drone warfare, mm-hmm. but like all these developments in the Ukraine war have lost 4 or 5 years where there's an escalation on the Ukrainian side and on the side of their Western backers. They all tend to be signs of desperation and of weakness. Yeah. So the current campaign, drone warfare campaigns, they have this idea that they can demoralize Russia or they can, wear it out. Yes. And create a position where they can force it to come to terms that suit them. As far as I can see, that's a complete and utter fantasy.
Oh, it is.
There is no basis for it, whatsoever. So I don't think they have the ante to raise to actually to a sufficient level that the Russian side is going to have to escalate. Russia's strategy seems to me to be doing what they're doing is advancing on the ground. To secure their objectives in relation to the Donbass, whilst at the same time conducting their own long range strikes against Ukraine. Strikes, of course, and drone warfare, missile warfare, which are much more effective, much more extensive, much more impactful than anything the Ukrainians are doing to Russia at the present time.
Well, I've got a time constraint. I've had you on for quite a while, but on a positive note, the whole concept of trying to wear Russians out, one only needs to look at Gorlovka as a prime example. Gorlovka, which is on the front lines, Gorlovka, which has not had water since 2014, 2015, because the Ukrainians keep hitting the water mains and the pumps with artillery or drones or missiles. Gorlovka's pre-war population was 380,000 people.
Right.
Gorlovka's present population is 320,000 people. Right. They refuse to leave. It's their land. They're Russians. And, my grandparents were born here, my great-grandparents, and the hell I'm going to leave. And
sure.
So, you have people that have spent quite literally over a decade, 12 years under fire. They won't leave. I've been to Gorlovka more than a few times. You see burned out apartments where Ukrainians will fly in FPV drones up to an apartment building, look in the windows to see if they see people in there, and then ram that drone in there to blow up the apartment. You see burned out apartments like this. I've driven up and down the highway of death, which is the basically the edge of the city, with drones taking out cars and artillery strikes. And the people there, and this is just a typical Russian mentality. This is our land. We're not going. That's it. You can kill me, but I'm not leaving. You can kill me, but you can't defeat me. That's the Russian mentality. You know, I may die, but I'm not going to be defeated. And defeat is stepping back. So
it was the same spirit that defeated Nazi Germany.
Exactly.
Patriotic War.
I mean, we've been invaded. People forget the first big invasion, pan-European invasion of Russia, was 1012 AD. Vyacheslav Khrabry, the Crown Prince of Krakow, and his Holy Roman Empire allies, well, German states. They grabbed Kiev. They pushed Vladimir Krasnosolnitsa out. They couldn't fix it. They couldn't hold it, though, and they got pushed back out. But after that, it was game on. You know, pretty much, there's very few countries in Europe that haven't had a shot at us at least once, or at least a coalition. Portuguese.
Russia has always survived, and I'm sure it would do so in the future. I only hope that we'll survive with Russia. You know.
Yes. I'm not a big fan of throwing nuclear weapons around. If we can avoid that, that's kind of
a
hard to fix issue right there.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Yeah, it was very, very hard to fix.
Yeah, you can rebuild after a conventional bomb. It's pretty damn hard to rebuild after a 50 megaton or 100 megaton or a kiloton or maybe a one megaton hole in the ground. So yeah, I prefer not to go down that road.
Sure. Me too.
So. Yeah, I've got kids. You know, I want to see grandkids and great grandkids and so on, sure. And not with two heads and three arms.
Right.
So
okay.
Thank you very much for joining.
Yes, optimistic note.
Yeah, on an optimistic note. Let's avoid all that.
Well, thanks for the conversation.
Thank you. And next time you're in Moscow, drop me a line.
Yeah, I'll definitely come. Yeah, I'll be back there in the next few months or so.
Sure. Oh, excellent.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, thanks. Drop me a line. I'll happily meet you.
Yeah, great. Thanks.
Yep. Bye. Cheers. Bye. Thank you, everyone. Cheers.